And good afternoon. It is 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. Coming up on the show today, the first hour will feature from an October 16th event at Novel Idea Bookstore. You'll hear Helga Rausch introduce, discuss, and also read from, and let me get my notes here. Here we go. Read from David Pates. I hope I'm saying that right. A book called The Worst Songs in the World, The Terrible Truth About National Anthems. That was published by Dundurn Press, 2024. The book was just released after his passing earlier this year. So they're doing this posthumously, joining Helga and all of them, discussing each and each reading from their own work. You'll also hear offerings by Terry Loveridge and Tanya Grudzinski. And in the second hour, I will mention, too, that this launch ran over an hour, so it will run into the second hour by maybe in that 5 to 10 minute mark. And so, but it will continue uninterrupted. And then in the second hour, following the conclusion of that, from an October 4th launch event at Novel Idea, you'll hear Pasha Mala launching his fourth novel called All You Can Kill. And also David O'Meara launching his Fiction J debut book called Chandelier. And before we begin, though, I want to mention briefly that we are, CFRC did launch its annual funding drive on November 1st, and it does run through December 31st, but hoping to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrading to our recording performance, upgrading done to our performance studios. And if we're really reaching out and hoping people will help us out as they have in the past, you can visit cfrc.ca. Anytime and make a gift. You can get a tax receipt if you go through Queens, or you can get a little bit of CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from a lot of amazing local donors. And donors who donate directly to the station through our website are eligible to receive gifts from CFRC, can be entered into weekly prize raffles. For every $5 donated, donors will receive a free raffle ticket. And the more you donate, obviously, the higher your chances are for winning our weekly prize draws featuring gifts from a number of local businesses. And donors, you can go that way, or if you go the other way, you can donate through Queen's University, again, through our website. If you do that, you're not able to claim gifts, but you do receive the benefits of a tax receipt from Queen's. So I just want to throw that out there. I also want to do this quickly, and then I will be right back.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, earn a ticket towards one of our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from wonderful local businesses including Harper's Burger Bar, Hotel Wolf Island, Improbable Escapes, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long & McQuaid, Martello Alley, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via cfrc.ca.
On Saturday, November 30th, the Independent Wrestling Academy, in cooperation with CFRC 101.9 FM, presents IWA Wrestling School of Rock. A portion of the proceeds from this family-friendly professional wrestling event will be donated directly to CFRC's annual funding drive. Tickets are available for $20 and can be bought through iwacanada.ca. The event is scheduled to take place at the Upper Hall of the Spire on 82 Sydenham Street. Doors at 5 p.m., opening bell will be at 5:30. Be sure to check out cfrc.ca and iwacanada.ca for additional event details. We hope to see you there, and we hope you're ready to rock the Spire.
And in case you missed it at the top of the hour, well, I should say, too, it's about half a minute after 6 o'clock, after 4 o'clock. And if you missed it at the top of the hour, just to reintroduce the show, you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. My name is Bruce, and I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. This is a program called Finding a Voice. And just my usual start of the hour announcement. Occasionally, some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited, drawn to the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And let's go ahead now with my recording of an October 16th event at Novel Idea Bookstore. Again, you'll hear Helga Rausch introduce, discuss, and read from David Bates, The Worst Songs in the World, The Terrible Truth About National Anthems. Again, that was published by Dundurn Press earlier this year. The book was released just after his passing earlier this year, and so it is a posthumous launch. And joining Helga and all of them discussing and reading from them their own work and talking about the book, and him, you'll hear offerings by her and Terry Loveridge and Tanya Gradinsky. And let's go ahead and do that now.
Thank you, everyone, for coming here this evening. And a big shout out to Novel Idea, once again, for being the venue for this launch, as they are for so many launches in Kingston. It really is a wonderful way to build community through this independent bookstore. And it's a treasure, and we have to fight tooth and nail or do whatever it takes to make sure that it prospers and succeeds in the long term. So just wanted to get that out there before I start. So why are we here this evening? You'll notice my T-shirt, University of King's College, MFA in Creative Nonfiction. When I retired from the Army and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up, Veterans Affairs said, we can help, and they gave me money to go to school. And so I chose to undertake an MFA in Creative Nonfiction because I knew I wanted to write a book about something to do with women in the military, women at RMC, my career, and I wanted to get that story out. And so they gave me money to go to King's. The King's program is a low residency MFA that takes place over 2 years. In our case, thanks to the COVID pandemic, it was a no residency program. So I met David Pate on Zoom in my second year when I joined the mentor group that was led by Ken McGugan, who many of you will know as a great Canadian writer. Most recent book, Shadows of Tyranny. And the first thing that struck me about David was that this guy could talk. He would just start talking in our Zoom sessions, and we would kind of have to, say, okay, Dave, we've only got 10 minutes left. You need to share the stage. But he was very interesting, very well-read, very witty, a very tall Scotsman, larger than life, which I realized when I finally met him in person in May of 2023, when we had our graduation ceremony, or as Kings likes to call it, Insania, which I always thought was kind of funny. Insane. But there it was. We were at King's College. It was the first time I stepped foot on the campus, and I got to meet David Pate, and like he's well over 6 feet tall, was as large a presence in person as he was on Zoom. He had a 40-year career as a journalist. He'd grown up in Scotland, emigrated to Dublin. That's where he cut his teeth as a journalist. He moved to, he met his wife in Dublin, and then was offered a job by the CBC in Halifax. So moved to Halifax, when was it? I think in 1989. Yeah. And he became a citizen in 1995. He retired in October of 2020, and he, as his third act, fourth act, I don't know, decided to become a writer. And he, when I met him, he was working on a book about condo living and decided to put it in the drawer, put it aside, and instead he worked on this book, The Worst Songs in the World, Terrible Truth About National Anthems. And it was very personal to David Pate. As a child growing up in Scotland, he had been beaten for refusing to sing God Save the Queen. And he then learned after that to just mouth the words so he wouldn't get caned anymore. But that fascination with the word he uses in his own book, the weaponization of anthems for political control, stuck with him, and he became very interested. He had a podcast about it, and this book, you think, well, what do we really know about anthems? Well, it's all in here. And he's hilarious. It's a weighty topic, but he's so funny. And it really... Having read most of it now, it is it really is a deeply researched, illuminating book about something we take for granted, and then actually offers practical ways forward. You know, do our anthems have to be bloodthirsty, misogynistic, and violent? Not necessarily. What can we do about it? So he does offer a way ahead in the book. So we graduated in May of 2023. In November of 2023, he sent a little note out to the gang saying, book announcement, Dundurn was going to publish his book. And then he, on February 9th, 2024, he passed away in his sleep. He'd been doing really, really well up until the last little while, and apparently it was complications of pancreatic cancer that took him in the end. So we found it, we passed it around on Facebook. We were devastated. Again, we'd seen him in May. He'd been larger than life. It didn't seem possible. Shortly after that, so March 7th, 2024, the cohort director for our program, Kim Pittaway, reached out to us and said, you know, Dundurn's not sure what to do with the marketing of this book because now they have no author. How's that going to work? And we're reaching out to you, his classmates, to see if any of you might be interested in hosting launch events in your home cities for his book. And well, they stepped up. We stepped up. 9 events from Halifax to Vancouver, 8 in-person events, 1 online event. This one is the second last event to take place. The last one will be in Vancouver. And it was a beautiful thing. Because those of you who are writers will know that writing, being an author, can be a solitary and isolating pursuit. And you gotta find community where you can. And the most powerful community that authors can belong to is a community of other authors. And one of the lovely things about the program that King's MFA offered was the bond that we forged through that. Even though it was online, on Zoom, we managed to forge a deep bond. And I have still accountability buddies from that course. So we check in monthly, and it's like, did you bang out the 5,000 words you said you were going to, and how's that going? But also providing encouragement and inspiration to one another. And that's so important. And so this reading event is really an evening of literary friendship. And that's why I asked Tanya and Terry, who are not King's MFA grads, but are friends and authors, to come and share their perspectives and their readings with us tonight. It's very important to have that community. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a little bit from David's book, and then I'm going to read a little bit from my manuscript in progress, because it's not due for publication by Dundurn until January of 2027. So I'm still frantically working on banging out those words. And then I'm going to invite Terry and then Tanya to read from their works. So everybody's heard La Marseillaise. So this is one of the stories that David writes about. The man who climbed onto our wooden patio table at the beer garden was wearing a large French flag around his shoulders and a hat shaped like a chicken. He started marching up and down, forcing us to grab our pint glasses before they were kicked to the ground. He sang as he marched, a familiar tune. Allons enfants de la patrie, le jour de gloire est arrivé. What does that mean, Tanya? Other chicken-wearing and flag-draped Frenchmen quickly joined in singing their national anthem, La Marseillaise. The sound swept along the crowded street. Aux armes, citoyennes, formez vos bataillons, marchons, marchons, qu'un sang impur abreuve nos sillons. The anthem over, the man who started it all jumped off the table and gave a quick bow. We raised our glasses as the crowd poured past us, heading for Auckland's Eden Park, where France was getting ready to meet New Zealand's All Blacks in rugby's 2011 World Cup. But what struck me on that sunny September afternoon wasn't the chickens, real or rubber, but the words of La Marseillaise. I knew it was a revolutionary song calling on the people of France to rise up. But now I wanted to know exactly what they were being called on to do. My French wasn't good enough, so I turned to Google for translation. I was shocked at what I found. Do you hear in the countryside the roar of those ferocious soldiers? They're coming right into your arms to cut the throats of your sons, your women. It gets worse. After marching on, the citizen army is encouraged to kill their enemies and let their impure blood water the fields of France. Stirring stuff. But really? Is this the kind of message any country wants to send about itself? Go after us and we'll slaughter you? Lots of countries do the same. The songs we sing to honor our nations aren't always kind and gentle. In fact, many of them are downright bloodthirsty, or religious, or sexist, or all of the above. Of course, most of us are unaware of what other people's national anthems actually say because we rarely hear them. And when we do, they're often in a language we don't understand. There's a certain pattern to national anthems. Countries born out of revolution tend to have bloodthirsty anthems that involve a lot of marching. It's hard to beat the French anthem on both counts, but plenty of others are in the running. China's March of the Volunteers encourages its people to brave the enemy gunfire by marching toward it, building a new great wall with their own flesh and blood. Vietnam urges its people to march along the path of glory over the bodies of their foes. And when it comes to glorifying warfare, Algeria sets the standard with lyrics that take the noise of gunpowder as our rhythm and the sound of machine guns as our melody. The author of Algeria's anthem allegedly wrote the words on the wall of his jail cell in his own blood while being held for interrogation by French colonial authorities, which probably explains the verse that warns France about a day of reckoning. Most of the revolutionary anthems are also big on praising liberty and throwing off the shackles of tyrants. Well, that pretty much describes every anthem in the Americas, except for Canada's. It's part of the world, the Americas is the part of the world where we find the greatest global concentration of violent anthems. That's because the countries of North and South America were mostly born from revolution. They often won their freedom in wars of independence, which became the foundations of their national identities. Their anthems were written to celebrate glorious victories and those who died fighting the oppressor. To make those deaths meaningful, the fight for freedom had to be portrayed as a mystical cause worth dying for. It all began in the United States, the home of the original People's Revolution. The United States, of course, is the land of the free and the home of the brave, and celebrates bombs bursting in air. But we know that those bombs don't burst for everyone. The promise of freedom remains an aspiration for some, as we've seen in the protests from the 1968 Olympics, with the Black Power salute to the anti-racist gesture of knee-taking at sporting events. Mexico's anthem promises no mercy to anyone who threatens the nation, tosses in a Marseillaise-like reference to watering fields with blood, has a lot of stuff about roaring cannons, and comes with a big shout-out to liberty. That's a lot of fighting for a country that hasn't seen a foreign invader since the end of the Mexican-American War in 1848. So then he goes back to the Rugby World Cup to talk about how anthems play into sports events, which are in fact a proxy for the battlefields. The idea that it would be nicer to replace gruesome anthems with ones that celebrate a little peace, love, and understanding seems obvious, but nations can't or won't let go of their pasts. And it doesn't seem to matter how long ago the blood flowed or what's changed in the meantime. Armchair warriors love their battle hymns. Unfortunately, we're usually so caught up in the moment that we often miss the message. Among the Rugby World Cup games I attended in 2011 was the only one that mattered for many Scottish fans, England and Scotland. England's team, of course, was serenaded with God Save the Queen. Scotland's song was its de facto anthem, Flower of Scotland. I had sung it often, but this time, because of my experience with the French anthem, I listened to what the lyrics said. And here's what you need to know about Flower of Scotland. It was composed in the 1960s by Roy Williamson of the Scottish folk group The Corries. By 1990, it was being played before rugby games. The football team was slower to adopt it, but it's now hard to imagine a Scottish sporting event, or indeed any Scottish occasion that requires the playing of a national song, without hearing Flower of Scotland. Scotland isn't technically a nation in the UN sense of the word, so it doesn't require an official anthem. But it's difficult to envision any other song taking its place if Scotland should ever regain its independence. Flower of Scotland is all about defining Scottish identity as the need to beat the English. There's a marvelous video that was produced for the BBC to promote the 2012 Six Nations Rugby Tournament. It starts in bewildering fashion with fans from Ireland, Scotland, and Wales all shouting, England! With apparent joy. Why, viewers might momentarily wonder, are all these people supporting their traditional enemy with such passion? And then the words appear on the screen. The Six Nations is not about who you want to win. It's about who you want to lose. And then it cuts to a bunch of slightly hapless English supporters in a pub saying, Scotland, France, Wales, definitely Wales, before the final caption appears, the Six Nations on the BBC, united in rivalry. It's hilarious, though the BBC refused to air it, calling it inappropriate. But the promo makers knew exactly what they were doing, because for the Irish, Scots, and Welsh, beating the English is what it's all about. That used to be done, or at least attempted, on the battlefield. And it usually didn't go well for the smaller nations. That fight has now transferred to the less violent world of sports, which, as George Orwell observed, is bound up with hatred, jealousy, boastfulness, disregard of all rules, and sadistic pleasure in witnessing violence. In other words, it is war, minus the shooting. And then finally, I want to read a brief passage that resonated particularly with the predicament in which I found myself for certainly the early part of my military career. When he talks about potentially changing anthems, he writes, "The first thing to do is to defang them. Make them nice. This will have the added bonus of reducing their effectiveness as ultranationalist symbols. It is precisely their nastiness that makes anthems attractive to right-wing opportunists who want to force people to sing them. Governments help with that by militarizing anthems. They are often played at public events by military bands, accompanied by warplanes screaming over stadiums and trailing smoke in the relevant national colors. If you weaponize the anthem by using it like that, it becomes easy to spot your enemies. They are the ones not singing, the ones without hands on their hearts, the ones who keep their hats on, the ones who reject national symbols for religious or moral purposes, the ones who kneel to demand racial equality. The anthem becomes a tool of the state, not a song for the people." And I'll stop reading from his book now, because this is a great segue into my little bit about songs and whether to sing or not to sing. As with perhaps some other male-dominated vocations, sorry, back up. This is from my manuscript in progress. The tentative title of the book is Leaders All, Women in the Canadian Armed Forces Since 1950. As with perhaps some other male-dominated vocations, many women in the Canadian Armed Forces faced a dilemma. Should they remain true to themselves as women and be dismissed as weak, or take on the masculine stereotypes that surrounded them in the hopes of gaining acceptance? In the early years of my career, I would not have said that I felt pressure to conform. I simply never thought of behaving otherwise. In my mind, the military's acceptance of women was such a fragile enterprise that my duty was to do everything in my power to become one of the guys. And that meant mimicking them, including singing their songs. I started early, a crusty former Royal Air Force officer supposedly mentoring air cadets in my squadron taught us some humdingers. The North Atlantic Squadron was probably the tamest. Away, away with a fife and drum, here we come, full of rum. We're looking for women to paddle their bum, and so on. The old engineer song was of a different order. It described an engineer designing a machine to satisfy his young, insatiable girlfriend. Of course, once the machine started, it could not be stopped, despite her cries. The words the old RAF officer taught us were graphic and violently misogynistic. It was 1976 and I was 13. I barely knew what sex was. I belted out the lyrics with gusto. During my six-week basic officer training boot camp in Chilliwack, BC, I mindlessly parroted rude marching songs to distract myself from the monotony of slapping one combat-booted foot in front of the other. I don't know, but I've been told, ad nauseum. Then I got to RMC. Royal Military College in Kingston exacted a new level of conformity. Women were in their third year at the place. I quickly saw that blending in was impossible. We were plainly told that women who went to RMC were either sluts or lesbians. So I leaned into a vague, long-distance relationship with a boy out west and did my best not to be too much of a girl. Within days of arrival, cadets were expected to be able to recite on command college trivia, such as the names of the old 18, the first 18 cadets in order by college number, or when this or that building was built. To aid in our mastery, we always carried a thin red book containing most of what we were required to know. Failing to produce the booklet or recite the demanded trivia was grounds for punishment, which consisted mainly of running laps around the track at night. In a breathtaking system of self-incrimination, masquerading as truth, duty, and valor, we were required to keep track of our circles and report ourselves each night. Chapter 7 was RMC March, Cheers, and Playing Colors. Under Battle Songs and Battle Cries was written, "As long as men have gone to war, or for as long as they have met in friendly strife on the playing field, they have had their battle songs, marching songs, and battle cries. Regiments, squadrons, and ships, teams, clubs, schools, colleges, and universities all have their songs and cheers, and so it has been, and so it is with RMC." The only college cheer written in the book was a reasonably tame call and response, or so I thought. It started with, "Gimme a beer," and we would shout at the top of our lungs, "Beer, S's, Emma, TDV, who can stop old RMC? Shrapnel, cordite, NCT, RMC." The book explained that "Beer SS Emma" denoted the first letters of an old term for the top cadet, battalion sergeant major. We certainly knew that TDV stood for Truth, Duty, Valor, the college motto, but the book did not define NCT. I knew the other terms had to do with artillery bombs, but I was stumped when a random senior cadet stopped me in mid-cheer to ask, "Now, Miss Rausch, do you know what NCT means?" I confessed that I did not. With a smirk, he assigned me 2 circles for being ignorant of college knowledge and instructed me to make sure that I knew the answer next time. Eventually, I found out that NCT meant, "Really?" I thought, but then was not surprised. We women made up our own version, but would never dare say it in the presence of the men. Nor did our version really make me feel any better. Fortunately, I did not encounter that senior cadet again, and I was never asked to recite it. What NCT really meant was a type of artillery fuse, but I would not discover that until long after I had graduated. Officially, today's cadets are taught only the correct historical terms. We also were required to memorize and sing on command the college song, titled Precision. It was a Victorian schoolboy's wet dream. Here I was in 1982, gamely singing about empire and being a gentleman. "We are the gentlemen cadets of RMC. We have sworn to love and serve Her Majesty, and will defend this land of liberty and strive to keep our empire's unity." Precision is still played by the band at parades and dinners, but the lyrics are generally not known by cadets, and those few who do learn only the first 2 verses, leaving out the bit about empire. There were more songs to learn after I was commissioned into the Army. Mess dinners were raucous affairs that involved excessive drinking and playing of regimental marches after the toast to the sovereign. We sang along with the most popular ones. The Navy's march, Heart of Oak, was, like so many other Canadian marches, handed down from the British. It rhapsodized about men and boys together at sea. "For who are so free as the sons of the waves? Heart of oak are our ships. Heart of oak are our men. We always are ready, steady, boys, steady." There was, of course, a rude version, noting the joys of autoeroticism. Some marches were old French folk songs, focused mainly on romantic relationships with women. The Royal Van Dusium Regiment's Vive la Canadienne praises the virtuous woman who gives love and many children to her soldier. Another from the 17th century celebrates spending one days and nights with one's girlfriend. "Oh, près de ma blonde, qu'il fait bon, fait bon, fait bon." The March of the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry is a medley of 3 First World War songs. "Has anyone seen the colonel?" Answer, "Dining with a brigadier." "Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know." And finally, "Mademoiselle from Armentières hasn't been kissed for 40 years. However, kissed was often replaced with the more carnal, vulgar verb. My male colleagues gazed appraisingly at me at these times to see what I would do. Would they despise me as a weak little girl if I demurred? Or would they despise me as an unnatural woman if I enthusiastically joined in. A lesbian, in those days, grounds for being drummed out of the forces. Or worse, would I be signaling looseness and openness to unwanted advances? But I had chosen to be in this man's world, and I was going to beat them at their own game, or so I hoped. Glass in hand, I sang every song, rude versions and all, at the top of my lungs. Thanks. So as you can tell, we're kind of leaning into David's makes connections between national anthems, nationalism, militarism. And given that this is Kingston and that I'm a veteran and my friends are veterans, we are leaning into that, the military aspects of things a little bit. I'm also leaning into the fraught situation for women as reflected in some of the national anthems and certainly in my experience in the initial years of my career. So I'd like to ask Terry to come up and read from his most recent book, which is The Road Past Monchy. It is a book from about the First World War, featuring the perspectives of the middle, the junior officers and the junior NCOs. Thank you, Terry.
I have to try to follow that, did I? I think Howie has given an appropriate enough introduction, except to say, when seen from the middle, that is, not the sanctified soldier in the trenches that everybody remembers from Alcoy on the Western Front, or the terrible generals who lived in chateaus and passed orders for the death of millions, it's a very different war. You don't get either of those perspectives, and that's what I tried to focus on. And I'm glad I picked the part that I'm going to read, because when you said national anthems, I think this bit will fit in very well. It's very early. We're going to talk about the opening of the war, which many people don't realize. I mean, we have those Downton Abbey, you know, the bright, bright summer and the green fields that everybody goes off to war. And it wasn't really like that. We're now beginning to understand, for example, there was a four-year weather anomaly beginning in 1914 that was going to prove very tragic for people who have to live in holes for the next four years, and a few other technological advances that these people had to deal with. But let's start off with 1914, as the large German Schlieffen Plan armies are sweeping down towards the Marne and Paris. The plan required that they continue south by Arras to protect the flank of the 34 German corps marching south toward the Marne River. It was 2 weeks before word reached Monchy of the miracle of the Marne. The French, with some British help, had won a hard battle, and the Germans were in retreat. The 45-day plan was dead. A French victory ensured the war was to continue, and Monchy was positioned for war. Most of the millions of Prussians, Württembergers, Bavarians, and Saxons who had marched to the Marne were conscripts and recalled trained reservists, called to assign caserns to be uniformed, armed, and deployed by rail in accordance with prearranged movement schedules. Conscript Stefan Westman was serving with the 113th Regiment, the 5th Baden, when war was declared. His company was assembled to hear its commander explain that the deteriorating international situation had rendered the new German Empire under imminent threat from surrounding hostile powers. So they were to march. Stefan was a medical student, and his commander assured him that after 6 months in the infantry, he could transfer to the medical branch. Tobacco merchant Fritz Nagel had to abandon a business trip to Antwerp and report to the 18th Reserve Division Artillery Unit in Bremen. His personal situation was somewhat complicated by his engagement to an English girl living in Germany and by his brother who lived in Kentucky and was a member of the United States Army Reserve. In the Duchy of Baden, 17-year-old student Otto Le reported to 169 Reserve Infantry Regiment, 8th Baden, in the Lahr Kaserne, south of Baden-Baden. He was a trained reservist and so was marching west 3 days after war was declared. Hundreds of thousands of untrained volunteers, including many students, turned up to take the oath to God and Kaiser, king for Saxons, Württembergers, and Bavarians, and be assembled into a reserve army. They did not expect to be committed to action before being trained. The war drew in outsiders from its outset. American Eric Fisher Wood was a postdoctoral architect at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris when intimations of war led him to refugee work for the American embassy. Witnessing war's tragedies could not inoculate him against the siren call to arms once he heard the French soldiers, the poilus, smashing their feet on Paris streets in time to the greatest of national anthems. It was the Marseillaise of war. Each word was a threat, an imprecation intense with ferocious meaning. Their intonation carried conviction that meant literally every impressive line they uttered. I felt exultantly certain that the French were going to smash the Germans into tiny bits, and was equally sure that they could, if need be, demolish all creation. Aux armes, citoyens, formez-vous les battalions, marchons, marchons. Wood joined the American Volunteer Ambulance Corps and was soon traversing shattered and shocking fields between the Marne and a Red Cross station at Doulon, which was being run by an American archaeologist. David Everett Wheeler was a 42-year-old Boston surgeon descended from Sir William Pepperell, the man who captured Louisbourg for the English crown in 1745. His family maintained its Canadian connection, and David hunted in and wrote about northern Canada and even spoke some Cree. Once the gun sounded, David set out with his wife Mabel for the American hospital in Neuilly, Paris. Mabel was a nurse with a social pedigree as long as David's and was the chair for the association opposed to women's suffrage. Mary Borden, in contrast, had a police record for suffragette action. She was an American heiress from Chicago and the niece of Vice President Adlai Stevenson. An expensive education had encouraged a talent as a budding novelist, and a hasty, likely rebellious marriage to a Scottish missionary had provided children and some facility in German, French, and Hindustani. But even by age 28, she had no real worldliness. Missionary service had stoked passion, but a return to Britain set Mary adrift in a circle of artists who inspired an unsatisfactory affair in literary pretensions. During a third pregnancy, she announced to her louche set that war could not happen in this global age. When the war Mary said could not come came, her group dissolved, and with it her ennui. War was an opportunity to make her life tell for eternity. She delivered her child, hired two nurses, and set out for a typhus hospital in France. She was on a trajectory to meet Lieutenant Edward Louis Spears, the first British officer in action on the Western Front. Spears, also 28, was French-raised and known to fellow cavalry officers as Edward, sometimes Beaucaire, but his friends called him Louis. He was sent as liaison to the French, an appointment that placed him in the presence of the high and mighty when they made and did not make decisions. Personal liaison was vital. The British and French had not worked together in living memory, and their armies were organized differently. There was no real command relationship, and everything had to be coordinated between unilingual generals. Liaison officers were expected to take accurate notes, pass messages without opinion, and know their place. But Spears could be bristly, and he had a suspiciously Jewish name. So most British suspected he was tainted by Francophilia, and the French assumed he was a well-meaning British spy. Conveying messages between brass hats made Spears familiar with the narrow roads and the narrower trenches of Picardy. He was dodging shrapnel and invective while armies across the British Empire were still drilling with sticks and without uniforms. Moment of suspense, I'll leave you there. I had to get that Marseillaise bit in. I was, I'll tell you a quick story. I was on the beach at Normandy for the 75th anniversary, and all the nations played their national anthems. The American one and God Save the Queen were familiar, but the only one that stirred anybody, regardless of nation, was the Marseillaise. All the others sounded like dirges. I mean, frankly, O Canada sounds like a hymn gone bad, but, you know, when everybody else is bup, 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 and I mean, you know, it's...
Please go ahead, Tanya. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Tanya Grudzinski. Thank you for being here, and thank you for Novel Idea for hosting this event. I should point out that Terry and I taught history alongside Terry at RMC, and Helga and I, our careers crossed paths several times, so I've known both of them for many years. Like Helga, when I retired in 2020, I wanted to redefine myself in a new career. And at Northside Cafe, I took a course to be a barista, and I spent a day making 50 coffees, you know, the crema, infusing the milk and so forth, and my 35th coffee was one that the instructor said, we would serve this in our restaurant. Mm-hmm. So then I went out and tried to get a job as a barista, and had I been 40 years younger, I would be working as a barista now, but unfortunately that didn't go. What I'm going to do right now is take a look at music. We've touched upon national anthems, martial music, and so forth that is used to stir various emotions, to inspire people, but also as a lament to remember the fallen. And alongside that, I want to explore the power of fiction versus nonfiction. Helga did a master's in creative nonfiction, which is a bit of a blend of the two, I would say, although she's raising her eyebrows at me. So, but one has a power that I'll leave you to decide what to do. So, and when we look at music, one of the things I thought of was there was an episode of MASH where Father Mulcahy begins to wonder why in the Korean War there are no martial tunes or patriotic tunes to stir people, much like the First World War. Everybody can name a tune from the First World War. Similarly, the Second World War, you know, a host of songs, but there was nothing for Korea. So he decided to write one himself, which essentially the message was, they're not singing war songs because they don't want to sing about war anymore. So there's this element, and today, you know, you don't see this happening coming out of conflict. And one of the tunes I'm going to explore, and I'll read some of the lyrics at the end, is Over the Hills and Far Away, which has its origin in the Wars of Marlborough of the early 18th century, famous for the battles like Blenheim and Ramillies, but which during the French Wars of 1793 to 1815, and not during the Seven Years' War or the American War of Independence, did we hear British soldiers singing this song. There are also many versions, and this tune was traditionally sung or played when a regiment left its cantonment, Over the Hills and Far Away. It gained popular fame with the television series Sharp, in which Sean Bean played the main character based on the books by British-American author Bernard Cornwell, and that ran from 1993 to 2010. And it was interesting, in the midst of the series, there was a bit of a trade war between Britain and France over beef, and there was questions of British beef being tainted. So the producers for the show grasped that theme for an ad for the TV series, where on this billboard you saw the torsos of these soldiers in their green uniforms, mud and filth on them, they're carrying their rifles, and across it says, even 200 years ago the French did not like British beef. So, music and patriotic songs were rampant during the period of this conflict, and often heard on the battlefield. Although some, such as the fictional Sergeant Patrick Harper, a close friend of Cornwell's protagonist Richard Sharp, enjoyed many of his tunes, although he was less kind towards the shite music played by the French at Waterloo. So, the description of battles, okay, conflict, military action, and nonfiction is often from the perspective of a large hand sweeping over a very small map that casts light on the grand movements of forces at the cost of the experiences of soldiers or junior leaders, as Terry pointed out. Britain's John Keegan and Richard Holmes changed this by exploring warfare from the perspective of soldiers. And Keegan's important 1976, The Face of Battle, reinvigorated the study of military history by exploring battle from the perspective of why soldiers fight, and in using personal accounts to describe the horror of battles. And one of the actions that Keegan refers to in his book, and this is an example of it here, was the Battle of Waterloo, fought on the 18th of June, 1815. Keegan's examination of the battle includes the wider campaign, a personal angle of the vision of a soldier, what the soldier saw, the physical circumstances of battle, categories of combat, including single combat, soldier versus soldier, whether that's cavalry versus cavalry, cavalry against artillery, artillery versus infantry, infantry against infantry, the aftermath of battle, and the story of the wounded. In describing cavalry versus cavalry, Keegan wrote of the major cavalry charges during the afternoon of this epic battle. So the battle began, the Battle of Waterloo began at midday with a massive French bombardment. The infantry stormed forward, and the British responded with a massive cavalry charge that was met in turn by a French cavalry charge. So in describing an action of cavalry versus cavalry, Keegan wrote that during this epic action of the afternoon of the battle, Morris, a sergeant in the 73rd Foot, relating his view of events during the great French cavalry attacks of the afternoon, writes that the Life Guards, which was a British cavalry regiment, boldly rode out from our rear to meet the cuirassiers. The French waited with the utmost coolness to receive them, opening their ranks to allow them to ride in. Consent, the vital precondition for single combat power, is thus made to appear equally necessary if cavalry formations were to fight each other in any effective fashion. When they did so, of course, they did not fight as formations, that is, large groups of cavalry soldiers, but as individuals or small groups. Morris continues his account with a description of the sort of fighting to which this opening of rank and allowing entry led. I noticed one of the guards who was attacked by two cuirassiers at the same time. He disposed of one of them by a deadly thrust to his throat. His combat with the other lasted 5 minutes. We are back again to single action. Remember that passage when I read the third one that I'll share with you. Now, to be fair, Keegan was using these descriptions of battle to support his thesis on the motivation of soldiers and their endurance during the horror of wars. But nonetheless, he integrated personal perspectives and from that tried to draw conclusions. And in a very different perspective, medical doctor Michael Howard, in this book, which I ordered through Novel Idea, Wellington's Doctors, the British Army Medical Services in the Napoleonic Wars, writes about the surgeons, the respective medical systems of the armies involved, and the ensuing horror that they encountered. Whether after a siege or pitched battle, wrote Howard, the reality of the Napoleonic battlefield was far removed from the glamorous portrayals of 19th century salon painters. After the struggle of Waterloo, the thousands of soldiers who lay on the field who could, quote, not help themselves were in want of everything. Their features, swollen with sun and rain, looked livid and bloated. In using extracts from accounts by soldiers and civilians and descriptive texts listing the numbers of casualties, Howard outlines the work of surgeons. Following the battle, he writes, civilians burying the dead with, quote, their noses covered in handkerchiefs to mitigate the stench, is followed with the, quote, onerous and unpleasant duty of the fatigue party sent to collect dead and wounded from the field following a battle. The grim humor of one surviving soldier, Sergeant William Lawrence, who recalled one soldier who was requested by his wounded colonel to carry him to the dressing station. The soldier acquiesced, but the night was dark and the noise so intense that he did not notice when a cannonball took the colonel's head off. On arrival, the surgeon inquired why he had brought back a headless trunk. The man indignantly pointed out that to the colonel that a head that the colonel had a head when he had found him. How else could he have been asked to be taken from the battlefield? So these are nonfiction accounts using personal accounts to describe battle, and you get a sense, but I now want to move to exploring a depiction of the cavalry charge based on this book, Sharp's Waterloo, by Bernard Cornwell. Some of his books are available here. He's written on numerous conflicts, but from a fictional perspective. So Sharp's Waterloo by Bernard Cornwell, first published in 1990. And the series of about 15 books is about Richard Sharp, a rifle soldier come officer during the Napoleonic Wars. So he had come up from the ranks, which in a very socially stratified military of the period resulted in him facing many problems. And by 1815, just at the prior to the Battle of Waterloo, he was a lieutenant colonel serving on the staff of the Prince of Orange, a Dutch member of the Dutch royal family who was given a senior command in the Allied Army at Waterloo. Facing him was the elegantly handsome, as Cornwell described, Lord John Rossendale, a captain in the 1st Life Guards, a household cavalry regiment, who, having stolen Sharp's fortune that he made in Spain and was now with his former wife, is Sharp's enemy. He too, that is Rossendale, is on the staff of Silly or Slender Billy, as the Prince of Orange was known. Disgraced during an encounter with Sharp, Lord John joins the charge of the Household Brigade, which involved two regiments of the Life Guards, the Royal Horse Guards, and the 1st Dragoon Guards. So this was heavy cavalry armed with swords and on large horses, where he meets his fate. And there's reference to Jane, the former wife of Sharp, who is now with Lord John. So on the eve of the battle, the Duchess of Richmond held a ball as part of the social scene in Brussels at the time. And Lord John Rossendale had bragged, or rather lied, about his skill in battle, claiming, as he had heard from another officer, that if you encounter a French lancer, a soldier who carries a lance, which is a rather lengthy weapon, all you have to do is get your sword past the lance points. But no one believed the inexperienced officer, whose position was worsened when he was challenged to a duel by Richard Sharp over other matters. So in mid-afternoon, on the 18th of June, 1815, Rossendale charges alongside the Union Brigade, and he finds that he, at long last, learned to kill. He learned the joy of losing all restraint, of absolute power, of riding into shattered men who turned, screamed, then disappeared as a sword thumped home. He found himself picking a target and stalking the man, even if it meant ignoring closer Frenchmen, then choosing the method of the victim's death. One he skewered through the neck, almost losing his sword because it pierced so far. He practiced the lunge, learning to control the heavy point of the blade. He soaked the steel in blood, sparkling droplets into the air with each victory, then lowering the point for more. He saw a fat French officer clumsily running away, and Lord John spurred through the closest Frenchman, stood in his stirrups, and slashed down with the sword. He felt the skull crumple like a giant boiled egg, and he laughed aloud to think of such a comparison at such a moment. The laugh sounded more like a demonic screech, a fit accompaniment to the screams of the other death-drunk troopers around him. And then, as Lord John galloped clear of the infantry, so I'm jumping ahead in the story, around him were knots of other horsemen, all galloping across the valley to assault the main French battle line on the southern ridge. The horsemen then found they had charged to glory and reached nowhere. The French infantry barred the promised road to Paris, and now that infantry began firing volleys that even at 200 yards found targets.
Time to go